This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Northwest Indiana artist and educator Jan Tischy. He is one of the key people involved in what is called the Heat Light Water Project in the city of Gary, and it involves the preservation of a building that has been long used as a government business center. We'll find out more. We'll also have a report as well, too, about Northwest Indiana and the rest of Indiana's small regional airports, and we'll also tell you more about a Portage family practitioner who's managed to get away from the medical insurance route for his services to go by what's called the direct primary care route. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A cultural project in Gary is moving into its next phase, getting involved in the saving of a bit of Gary city history. The Heat Light Water Project takes its name from the former General Services Building, which, when it was built in 1926, was known as the Heat Light Water Company. Jan Tischy is a Chicago-based artist and educator who, along with his colleagues, believe that just as heat, light, and water are essential to life, so are art and culture essential in any society. Our conversation began with the question, why choose Gary, Indiana?
Gary, Indiana, I see as a, you know, part of the larger Chicagoland area. I feel like through that, it is part of where I live. Things that are happening in Chicago have immediate implications in Gary and vice versa. One of my better known projects from 2011, the Project Cabrini Green, that dealt with the demolition of the last high rise of the Chicago public housing. You know, even from there, people were pushed out and made it to Gary. So there are so many connections. I'm professor at the School of the Art Institute. Many of the faculty live in Miller, in the beach neighborhood of Gary, Indiana. So there are plenty of connections, you know, to sort of feel in some way as well responsible for what is happening in Gary, Indiana, and, you know, last 30, 50 years.
Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting project. It's a multifaceted project, I note. It has to deal with not only something that you can see on exhibit, but you can hear as well, too. Tell us about how the documentary photography as well as the radio workshop all fits in together with what you're planning.
You know, the Heat Light Water project is, in a way, a platform. Platform to do a couple of things. First of all, to try to think if the building can be saved, and in that case, what it should be, what it should become. And, you know, the answer for that, apart from the larger notion that we know from the mayor, that some type of a cultural center is needed in the city. But otherwise, it, you know, what that mean could be so many things. Culture is you know, wide term. And so it is really up to the citizens of Gary to determine what they think could and should be to be able to, you know, to activate it properly and own it. And therefore, what we are trying to conduct, apart from different steps with historical preservation, with writing grants to see where money could come for evaluations, for proposals, and finally possibly for investors to come in. But at the same time, thinking, you know, what could happen there, and so conducting different workshops, different activities that might relate to questions of heat, light, and water, because they are so essential elements of our lives, but also to, you know, what me and my fellow artists from Gary and Chicago know, and what is it that we can actually bring as expertise. I'm professor of photography, and therefore, you know, one of the things that started to happen was this photography club that right now actually is not really happening because many of the members had to leave Gary to look for jobs elsewhere. the radio workshop came 3 years ago, and thinking about different ways of communication in a place that is so physically broken, and how we can communicate with each other. The most recent project that was NEA supported from last year is the GLOW project, the Gary Light Open Works by artist Marisa Benedict and David Reuter, that think about how to bring physically light to specific places around the city, in a place where light, public light, is missing. Most of the neighborhoods are almost in complete darkness, and the public lighting is mostly alongside Broadway. Next year, we're planning to to think about murals together with a couple of the local high schools in different manner, and introducing something that one of our artists, Amanda Yamasaki, is calling the conductive mural, something that that can work with kids or students or residents in a particular area, and sort of think together what the public space could afford in the sense of education and interactivity, and so on and so forth.
I thought that the Open Light Project is very interesting here, and you mentioned a very important part of a fact of life, unfortunately, in Gary, isn't it? Because Gary is so spread out, the population so spread out, and with these sections of the city that are still pretty much abandoned, although that in some places they're very well populated, you still have, you say you have very few streetlights, and you say the Broadway main business district along Broadway is about the only one area that you will find a lot of streetlights that are still up there. So this would be very interesting to see if they can accomplish this task, to be sure. Jan, if you will talk a little bit here, I guess, about the opportunity that citizens in Gary and others who are interested in Gary's history and the future in particular of the city of Gary can take part in this changing Gary, a way to document what you describe as the changing and disappearing city, and the fact that you have regular meetings to talk about this.
Well, something that was really part of the photo club, but, you know, people and friends of the project, like Sam Love, that is documenting the changing city for the last 20 years, creating this amazing archive that, you know, really allows you to look back. There are some of amazing archives in the city, from the archives at the university, at the also with the Historical Society in Gary, and we hope that, you know, any of these activities around Heat Light Water Project that creates documentary material can be kept in some way and be part of these historical treasures.
We should mention that the opportunity, if you'd like to find out more about the project, it comes on Saturdays at 10 o'clock, and there's a regular meeting at the Borman Square Park Pavilion in Gary. So you go to the Borman Square Park, and you can meet with the folks like John and others that are interested in preserving a bit of history of the city of Gary and doing what they can to help the city move along here, along with what the city officials are trying to do as well in preserving and developing the city of Gary. There are some other people I know that are involved in the project, other artists and the like that are involved. Tell us about the other colleagues and how they're fitting together in the project.
Well, you know, it is really a project that brings together artists, educators, and cultural producers that live in Gary and that live around, that teach at the university or local high school as well, like me, at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so people like Sam Love, photographer, activist, and historian that lives in the city and documents and works with the local youth, has a certain perspective. Artists like David and Marisa from the GLOW project that are coming from outside and bringing their expertise in technology and communication is something that sort of needs to come together organically according to the needs. And so when last year we felt that there is a response, there is a need coming from the educational system in Gary, working with the Bowman Academy, with the Steel City Academy, and this year talking with Emerson. And so, you know, it really depends on what is needed and what one of the participants can provide. And so now with the educational element, you know, things like STEM projects dealing with the education of technology are a priority, and we have an artist that that is doing that. And so that will be our focus for the next year. Actually, rather than, for example, the photography project that we are still, you know, trying to bring it back and engage members of the community to really go out and document the changes around.
Now, I know that in conjunction with the work that you're and your colleagues are trying to do to preserve the General Services Building, hence the name of the project being Heat, Light, and Water. What's the latest on that, and as well as how you're trying to get the funds together to be able to make sure that the building is truly preserved?
Mm-hmm. Well, the latest on that is that 2 weeks ago on a weekend, we did this board up, clean up, cook up, Art Saturday, where the artists from the Calumet residency in Miller came with their project of a public poetry, mm-hmm. where they are using the boards to board up building as the screens, as a placement for poetry that local high school students, and this time these were from the Steel City Academy, wrote. And so, you know, using art to help physically preserve the buildings, we were boarding up because, you know, some of the boards over the last year fell down. There is vegetation coming in. And if we are thinking seriously about trying to save this building, you know, the winter is coming, and the building needs to be properly boarded up. Mm-hmm. And so we were, you know, be able to do it in a way that different parts of the community came together for this day in a very creative way, and, you know, something that that engaged a lot of dialogue between people from different places in Gary with different interests coming together and working for a day. And, you know, if you pass now by the building, it's just so wonderful to see all of these colors and these words coming out of the building, literally screaming, you know, there is something that needs to be preserved, needs to be saved.
Now, Jan, if anybody's interested in finding out more about this project, can they go on online to find out more about not only what you're trying to do, but to be able to offer your show of support for it?
There is a heatlightwater.org website that has some of the information, and you can always reach us through the website and mm-hmm. through the email. We are obviously on social media and reachable, and looking to be in dialogue with whoever is interested in, you know, preserving Gary and making this happen.
That's great to hear. Jan Tischy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Jan Tischy is a Chicago-based artist and educator, and he heads up what is called the Heat, Light, Water Project in the city of Gary. The success of Indiana's small regional airports ebb and flow in tune with the economy. Most airports have seen downturns in business and aerotourism in the past few years, but they're reaping the benefits that come from involved local sponsors and pilots. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle reports.
A lot of times on a Saturday morning, pilots do what we like to call go out for the $100 hamburger.
The $100 hamburger, Putnam County Regional Airport spokesman J.R. Scott is talking about, is slang in the pilot community, meaning an excuse to get out and fly. Many pilots did just that for the airport's annual appreciation days this summer. But it was much more appealing to fly to Greencastle's regional airport when it had a restaurant, hotel, bar, and conference center on the field, Scott says. Those services have since been diminished or closed down completely. Dozens of other airports around Indiana face the same kind of issue: how to improve when money and income sources are scarce. One way to do that is the Airport Development Fund, a grant available to federally funded public use airports where three entities split an improvement project's cost. There are 65 airports in the National Airport Systems Plan and 70 in the Indiana Department of Transportation's State Plan. Under the grant, the federal government fronts 90% of a project's cost, and NDOT splits the remaining 10% with the local airport sponsor. Here's NDOT Aviation Manager Martin Blake.
When the airports are constantly improving themselves and taking advantage of these great federal programs out there, you know, the FAA does not have an attitude of build it and they will come. It's we're helping you build and maintain it because they're already there.
Blake says NDOT hopes to release the latest edition of Indiana Airport's Economic Impact Study this fall. When it was last released in 2012, general aviation airports reportedly contributed to more than $5 billion of the state's $14 billion in economic output. Municipalities, such as the city of Frankfurt, want a bigger piece of that economic pie. Officials there approved a multi-million-dollar hangar project this year in hopes of bringing in more corporate jets. Frankfurt Mayor Chris McBarnes says the airport was a sticking point with ConAgra Foods executives. He hopes the accessibility, plus the short drive from Frankfurt to Indianapolis, attracts more attention.
If the Super Bowl ever comes back to Indianapolis, we want to be in the running. If celebrities are flying in G6 jets, we want to be in the running for them to fly into Frankfurt and to be able to house their jets here.
Back in Greencastle, J.R. Scott says the airport is the reason global material handling manufacturer Crown Equipment planted its business in Putnam County. Scott says a runway can be as important as Main Street, and local officials are noticing.
Like I said, the airport's going to be their first impression of Greencastle community, of Putnam County, and we want that to be a positive and reflect positive on our community to them.
For privately owned airports, such as Franklin's Flying Field, federal grants can't be applied, and there's no local sponsor trying to hook corporate jets. Instead, manager Robert Cohen is using the money he makes from building rent, flight school, and selling planes on the side to rehabilitate the airport. Cohen says when he was a child, the airport hosted fly-ins every year, but the practice eventually stopped and the airport was abandoned. He says it's going to take years, but he's got the same goal as other pilots, to make sure as many as possible can enjoy the airport.
I want them to come back out. That's about it. Come out, hang out, see cool planes, enjoy the community that we have here.
Cohen says it's been at least a decade since the field drew in a big fly-in crowd of more than 600 people. In Putnam County, thousands turned out for the Airport Appreciation Days. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in West Lafayette.
A car crash and a mistrial cast doubts on court-ordered mental health exams. Steve Berger has the first of two reports for Side Effects Public Media on how courts determine mental competency in Indiana and what system oversight is in place to make sure that defendants have a valid examination.
This story actually begins at a tree on a curve on Indiana State Road 46 east of Bloomington, where Albert Fink crashed his 2012 BMW sedan. What Fink didn't know is that two Indiana State Police detectives were right behind him that day. ISP Sergeant Kurt Durnell says the detectives encountered a strange situation. Fink told them the crash was deliberate.
Once they realized what had happened, they had a conversation with Mr. Fink.
And what happened?
What was it about? You know, I'd say it was not ordinary, and that his intention was to commit suicide right here on the strip.
Fink had been on his way to testify as an expert witness at the arson and explosives trial of Caleb Loving. Vandenberg County Prosecutor Nick Herman, who was trying that case, says his office got a call from a state trooper who said,
"Hey, you know, this doctor was in an accident, and he says that he falsified a report and he was going to be called as a witness the next day." We quickly realized that that was the trial we were in.
Dr. Fink had filed a report that said Loving was mentally competent to stand trial. The only problem was he'd never met Caleb Loving. Loving's defense attorney, Stephen Owens, says he'd already been suspicious of Fink, who was reluctant to testify about the competency exam he said he performed.
So I talked to him probably three times, and each conversation got a little more odd. I would have described that those conversations as squirrely, I guess is the way I would have described it. After that, I started looking into jail visitation records and discovered that there was no listing of him being there.
85-year-old Albert Fink is a psychologist often hired by the court. He's performed dozens of these evaluations over the last 10 years. The judge declared a mistrial in Caleb Loving's case, but Fink's scene-of-the-crash confession called into question not only the trial he was slated to go to, but everyone he'd ever worked on. Herman says it prompted a massive, months-long investigation.
It was a large effort, and a lot of different agencies participated in and helped with that investigation. It was a troubling case in that you had a person that is literally hired by the court to come in and testify about something that, you know, is lying.
Almost a year to the day after he crashed into the tree, Dr. Fink pleaded guilty to a felony charge of obstructing justice. He received probation and had to surrender his professional licenses. So, Albert Fink was caught and punished, but according to Owens, here's the scary part.
If Albert Fink had not crashed his car and admitted to the officers that he falsified those mental evaluations, would he have ever been caught?
I'd have to say maybe. And whether it would have been this case or not, I don't know. I'd like to think that somebody at some point would have caught up with him. Obviously, we didn't catch up with him all these other cases.
How many other cases? SideEffects has obtained a list of cases that turned up during the investigation in which Albert Fink is suspected of possibly falsifying the exams. We'll discuss that in our next segment, as well as why the conviction of Albert Fink has raised serious questions about how courts determine competency in Indiana. For SideEffects, I'm Steve Berger.
We'll bring you the second part of Steve Berger's series tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. A family practitioner, a physician in Portage, started out as just a regular practitioner, taking advantage of the usual opportunities to cover not only the costs of his office, his staff, and operations, as well as helping his patients pay their bills through the usual means. But he's decided to go unconventional, and we're now going to find out more about it. Dr. Timothy Ames is with us. Dr. Ames, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak.
If you will, please explain the term that is being bantered about these days, and you obviously take advantage of it because that's what you're into now. It's called direct primary care. What is direct primary care?
Direct primary care is a way of paying for primary care medicine that eliminates the interaction between the patient and the physician and insurance companies. Patients don't pay per visit, typically, though sometimes there's a small copay depending on the practice. But primarily they pay with a subscription fee, typically every month or every year, so that they have an ongoing relationship with the physician that allows far more flexibility in how the physician and the patient can meet the patient's needs.
Mm-hmm. How long have you taken up this this direct primary care option as part of your practice, as opposed to, I'm sure, many, many years before of just being in the traditional way?
Well, I've been doing this for 2.5 years now, and honestly, I did it, and I spoke with about a number of people, and you had a presence on Facebook, as I suppose everybody does. And it's only been recently, with a publication of a couple of articles in Northwest Indiana Times, that enough people became familiar with it that I've encountered a great deal of enthusiasm. And I also think that not only is this a good time in my life, but it's a good time in, you know, the history of the healthcare industry to look at alternatives to insurance involvement with every transaction.
Tell us how this opportunity that you have to go with this rather, at least what seems to be unconventional way of offering a help for your patients as well as for them, I guess, to basically to pay for their needs in health care. How does this have had an impact over time, certainly with your practice? And what do you do differently now that you didn't do before with just the conventional method?
Well, the way you run a direct primary care is very much different than running a typical fee-for-service practice. In a fee-for-service practice, for the greatest part, the only activity that generates revenue for the practice is when the patient comes in and has a traditional office visit. And what I found to be the problem with that was that everything that the practice did that was not an office visit, did not generate revenue, and just through natural forces, was not a priority. In a lot of cases, was not done as well as people would like. An example is if you speak with patients about how difficult it is to get a prescription refilled. And you'll hear very many stories about patients who call and say, I called the office, two, three times, and I still can't get my prescription refilled. Well, the problem is that when you have a primary care clinician who has to see 20 or 25 patients a day and respond to all sorts of urgent needs, refilling a prescription doesn't generate any revenue for the practice and gets pushed to the bottom of the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And in my practice, everything that helps the patient is equally important because I don't get paid for one particular activity over another. I, frankly, get paid for having a relationship and devising ways to meet the patient's needs.
Would you say that the way that you do things now with your practice is similar or very different from we'll say the really old way? I mean, we're talking like back in the 50s and 60s when there were a lot more doctors, a lot smaller offices and smaller practices where you were doing a more personal contact with your patients.
I think it has some similarities to the old ways of doing practice. Primary care medicine was for a very long time a largely cash business.
Mm-hmm.
And what changed about that is insurance changed, the nature of insurance benefits changed. Also, frankly, the practice of medicine changed. And the current fee-for-service payment system was really devised to meet the needs of a medical care industry that was treating acute and often very significant illnesses like appendicitis or pneumonia. Now, 75% of medical care is the treatment of chronic illnesses. And the economic model, which does a fine job of taking care of an appendectomy, does a very poor job of taking care of a problem which somebody needs constant care and constant monitoring over a term of years or decades.
Not like diabetes, for example.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And diabetes has become much more prevalent. Hypertension, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This is the bread and butter, frankly, of primary care now. And the idea that you're going to pay for each encounter for a problem which benefits from frequent but not terribly resource-intensive contacts,
mm-hmm,
is really misguided. I think it is far more productive to say, I will take care of you. And if you need to come in for an office visit, I'm certainly available, and I'm far more available than in a fee-for-service system because I don't have to see so many patients a day.
Right.
If I can aid you by talking with you on the telephone for 10 minutes, I don't have to worry about whether or not some insurance company is going to decide that speaking on the telephone is worth paying for. I have secure email facilities. And so, you know, if you want to tap out a couple of lines about your treatment, and you know, it doesn't matter whether or not I get back to you at the end of the day, that works as well. Again, insurance companies are just now thinking of ways to reimburse all the different sorts of interactions that we can have with modern technology in the 21st century. And in part, direct primary care gets around it by saying, I'm not going to wait for the insurance companies to decide that what I do and my ideas have value. Mm-hmm. If I think they have value and my patients think they have value, they are valuable.
Well, that's the important thing, the only important thing, I guess, when you think about it, too, isn't it? We're talking with Dr. Tim Ames. He is a family practitioner in Portage. He was doing the typical big service, so to speak, a service as far as being a physician is concerned. But he has decided to go the route of what's called direct primary care and serving the patients a lot better than just being in an office with a lot of other doctors. Tell us a little bit, Dr. Ames, about your particular practice there in Portage. If somebody comes by or wants to come by and talk to you or go in for an exam or whatever the case may be, how do they get in touch with you, and what do they see when they come into the office?
Well, the way they get in touch with me is very many people call me on the phone, and frankly are quite startled when they call my office number and I answer.
Uh-huh.
I am at the point of hiring some staff, and so they won't necessarily get me, but it's not the dense multi-layer phone tree which you encounter at a lot of places. And what I ask them to do typically is to go to my website, which is jtimothyames.com, and as I say, the letter J, timothyames.com. And there's a statement of purpose and also some blog entries and various things. But at the bottom of my statement of purpose, there is a link to a second website where patients can sign up to join the practice and give some of their basic information and provide the payment information which I need. And at that point, either I or a member of my staff reach out to them and get them scheduled for an appointment. I am working in the Porter Stark Services facility in Portage, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that keeps overhead very low in direct primary care is I don't need a great deal of office space. And I am working out of a modest office and two examining rooms right now, and it works out perfectly fine. If I were trying to get through 20 or 25 patients a day, I couldn't possibly do it.
I can certainly see that. Now, if a patient comes in and you come in for an exam, and you recommend they go in for some tests and some other procedures, what happens to those people after that point, since you have such a small operation?
Well, in terms of tests, one of the things that I offer is access to laboratory tests at a very highly discounted rate, as long as insurance doesn't need to get involved.
Right.
And so, there are a great many tests that I can offer for a tiny fraction of the rates that people are charged through their insurance. I also am able to provide many people with medication, which I obtain from a wholesaler and dispense from the office. And sometimes the discounts are quite astonishing. I had a patient recently who I first met her, and I had to write her first prescription, and she called back and said, this is over $200.
Wow.
And I was able to obtain it from my wholesaler and furnish it to her for $13.50.
That'd be almost as good as having free samples from the salesman that happened out of a handy, which I know has happened, of course. Doctors get samples from pharmaceutical salesmen who come by, and they drop off certain things, and they hang on to those. And sometimes if it's something very simple, you sometimes end up getting like a little bottle with a few pills to see how this is going to work, I suppose. It'd be about the same way, wouldn't it?
Well, it's the same, but I've had a great deal of experience with samples down through the years.
Yeah.
And what I finally concluded about samples is that they don't sample the good old-time reliable medicines that I like. There's a great deal that the pharmaceutical industry develops that is revolutionary and you know changes people's lives. But quite honestly, a lot of what is sampled in physicians' offices are what are referred to as me-too drugs.
Yeah.
You know, the fourth drug of a class, which is no better than the first drug of the class, which is available for, you know, frankly, pennies a day.
Yeah.
And so, right now I don't stock any samples, and I would have to have somebody come and make me a very cogent case as to why those are important.
No, I see. Yeah.
For, you know, many direct primary care practices have found that the discounts on medications that patients can get often pays completely for their subscription.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's a very important benefit. And becoming acquainted with almost an underground, if you will, of people who do medical services for cash at very, very reasonable prices. You know, for instance, I have one vendor that I send patients to for x-rays that has what I consider to be very reasonable charges as long as they don't have to get the insurance companies involved. This is an idea which has been around for a while. It's been growing in popularity, and I'm glad that I could pick up on it.
It's growing in other places in the country. Do you think that, though, it will pick up here in Northwest Indiana?
I think the enthusiasm that I've encountered with this as, you know, I got, I suppose, a break I'm very grateful for from the Northwest Indiana Times has showed me that once people are exposed to this, and get an explanation of what it is, they understand how it can help them. There's also a great deal of disillusionment with the healthcare insurance industry. I'm running into a number of patients who do not have insurance, which I don't encourage that because, honestly, you know, if somebody has, you know, severe trauma or needs major surgery or something like that, I think there ought to be means to pay for it. But, you know, there they are, and I wish to be of use to everybody. I think also there are a lot of people who have insurance, which in a way keeps them from getting care because they have insurance, they pay a very costly premium for it, but then before the insurance company writes a single check for their care, they have to go through a very substantial deductible.
Right.
And, you know, I run into a number of people who say, yes, I have insurance, but no, I cannot afford to go to the doctor because, you know, it's going to cost me so much out of pocket that, you know, I find this insurance a hindrance to care, not a gateway to care.
Well, Dr. Ames, the best of luck to you in your practice. This is an interesting concept, and we certainly hope that not only your idea of taking advantage of what is a popular way of treating people and helping people pay for their medical care is doing a good job here in Northwest Indiana. We're talking with Dr. Tim Ames. He is a family practitioner in Portage who has taken up the route of what is being called direct primary care, and we appreciate you taking time to talk with us today, Dr. Ames.
The opportunity to speak with you, and I would be very happy to speak with anybody who is interested in this idea.
Lake County and East Chicago could have new affordable housing by 2020 as part of a state tax credit program called Moving Forward. It's how officials plan to fulfill a promise to help East Chicago residents who've been displaced by lead contamination. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports on the long-term effort and what advocates say officials should do in the short term.
Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority Executive Director Jake Sipe says Moving Forward tries to rethink affordable housing as about more than just a number of units.
We're defining success by the impact that we can have on the community that encourages economic development, but also thinking about the residents' success and how they can continue to be upward mobility on their economics and their jobs and their quality of life.
Sipe says the program started with a focus on transportation and energy, but has grown to cover the whole cycle of poverty and innovative ways to break families out of it. Developers chosen for the program have to hold a workshop to brainstorm solutions before deciding where to build. The latest Moving Forward focuses on Lake County, and Sipe wants at least one project to end up in East Chicago. Governor Eric Holcomb's February emergency declaration for the city's lead crisis directed the State Housing Authority to spur affordable housing development in the area. As part of it, Sipe says they'll try something new at the Moving Forward workshop in November. They've invited two residents who were forced to leave East Chicago's badly contaminated West Calumet housing complex. Uprooted residents want first dibs on any new housing nearby, which Sipe says the state will keep in mind.
They're the experts when it comes to the types of housing that will provide them with the greatest opportunity to be successful.
Housing Justice Attorney Kate Walls has worked in East Chicago for more than a year and says residents need that voice if the state hopes to change their lives.
I think oftentimes what the mistake is with affordable housing design is they sort of come up with it first on their own and then apply it to the community without getting their input.
The developers tapped for Moving Forward in Lake County say they don't plan to do that. Pete Schwiggerod is a senior developer at Ohio-based Miller Valentine Group. He says they work with local nonprofits at the majority of their projects.
To simply house someone is only providing a good home, and to empower someone, you really need to have an approach that includes education and training and betterment systems.
The latest Moving Forward's other developer is Up Development, which ran Chicago's Cabrini Green housing project in 2008 when a rusty gate fell and killed a three-year-old boy.
I mean, it was a terrible tragedy.
Company president Jessica Burzak says Up and the city settled with the boy's family and learned a lot about managing and listening to tenants. That's why she says her company is excited to work directly with East Chicagoans.
I never want to impose a plan on a community or a person, but instead hopefully, you know, add good ideas to what they already desire for their own lives.
The community has plenty of ideas already, including on how public officials can help in the short term. East Chicago residents affected by lead have written to state, federal, and local officials asking them to pay for more relocation of former West Calumet residents and others. No agency has indicated they'll provide that funding, but Attorney Kate Walls hopes they'll reconsider.
That's a standard, if not typical, use of federal and housing community development funds, and I don't think it would leave the state without more than enough resources to do other work.
Jake Sipe with the State Housing Authority says it's done everything the governor asked. Moving Forward's two Lake County developments aren't slated to open until around 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Well, it's Monday, and that means it's time once again for John Kane for South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Meg Roman and Jason Canola. Meg is executive director of the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, and Jason is housing monks. Not yet, but soon. He will be housing monks, Tibetan monks specifically. And welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So, Meg, let's start with you. This is, many times now.
This is the fourth year.
Fourth time.
We're very excited to bring them back, and it's become a signature event for us.
And how long did the Tibetan monks, these are monks who, they live in India, is that right?
That's correct.
And then they tour they tour all countries.
They do, yes. And they've toured the United States and Canada several times.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I have been a part of their tours for about 13 years now.
How did you get hooked up with these monks?
They were touring Lafayette, Indiana. We used to live down there, and we just got hooked up as volunteers as they toured Lafayette, and we helped them for about 10 years, and then we moved to Northwest Indiana, and got asked to host as soon as we moved, so then we started touring, hosting the tours up here.
Yeah. Is it called the Diprang Monastery?
Drepung Gomang Monastery.
Oh, you said it correctly. Before we started the interview, we discussed South Shore Arts, the organization I work for, hosted the monks in early, it was sort of our millennial thing to do, and they created a mandala for us. And so what are the activities that will take place while the monks are in residence in Miller?
Well, we have several things going on. We have a sand mandala that's being created in Miller, and there's going to be a community peace puja, which we've done during each tour, and that's at the Aquatorium in Miller Beach also.
What does that consist of?
That consists of them chanting several prayers, and then there's a community drum circle immediately following, and we usually have a great, really fun time with the community.
Their chanting is really powerful, I think.
Well, the first year we did it, I don't think the community really knew what was going on. So there were mostly the monks were doing the drumming, but a few people had brought one or two things. By the second and the third year, the entire community came. People would ride their bikes with cymbals and drums and filled up the entire second floor with everybody from, you know, 3-year-olds to 85-year-olds. So it's really a very intergenerational, everybody, all walks of life.
And how long does the mandala stay? That will be at the Gardner's Center, right?
Yeah, that will start on...
The opening ceremonies on Tuesday, October 24th, and the deconstruction ceremonies on Saturday, the 28th.
The opening ceremony is exciting, too. Mm-hmm. And then the deconstruction, does it get swept up and then taken to, like, Michigan or something?
Right, so they basically spend 5 days... 4 to 8 monks are working on it at any one time, and it's incredible to watch it being, it's a painting on the ground made of individual pieces of sand.
Exactly.
And then people can come and watch the progression, and then at the end they sweep it all up, and that's part of the ceremony to bring it down to the lake, Lake Michigan in Marquette Park, and they release it into the water to share it with the rest of the world.
The universe.
It's incredibly... moving and beautiful. And
it is. And a mandala, we should say, is a big round, it's a big round disc, intricate design, beautiful colors, and all of the sand has been dyed, these brilliant colors, and then they sort of, I don't know what those tools are called that they use to...
I don't know the Tibetan name either, but it's kind of a cone shape.
Yes.
And they have different size of these tools.
Right.
Just like we would use a pencil with either a very fine tip or a very wide tip. And they use one that rubs on another, creates a vibration, and then one sand particle at a time drops out
of it.
It's
amazing.
Yeah.
Last year, actually, somebody accidentally swept across a piece of the mandala, and then they just fixed it. Like, even that was amazing to watch.
Yeah, their patience on the part of the monks is just incredible. So they're going to be staying, Jason, with you and your wife for a whole week. That's exciting.
Yes, we'll have 8 monks, their driver, our 2 children, and dogs and cats. So the house is very full.
And they'll cook? Will they cook sometimes for you?
Yes, they cook, and we help cook, and we all eat together every day. It's a very fun and filled week.
It's exciting. Well, I'm glad you were here to talk about it. And thanks for coming, and thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
This is John Kane with his guests, Meg Roman. And she's, from the Miller Arts and Creative District in the Miller neighborhood of Gary. And Jason Canola. And they're all bringing the Tibetan monks back to Northwest Indiana for the fourth time, starting on October 24th. And you can hear this and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, on the page for the Eye on the Arts, and we can hear another Eye on the Arts conversation next Monday right here on Regionally Speaking. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we'll check in with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute.